This podcast from Institutional Real Estate Incorporated is made possible by the generous support of our sponsors. For information about sponsorship, go to irei.com and click on the sponsorship link.
Hi, this is Mike Consul, editor of the Institutional Real Estate Letter for the Americas. Welcome to the program. Our topic is urban retail, and to discuss the subject with us is an individual who's deeply steeped in retailing. That would be Robert Bellinger, the CEO of ASB Real Estate Investments. He has more than 29 years of experience in real estate investment and has completed more than $10 billion worth of transactions during his career. Robert, it sounds like you've been around the block a few times. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Mike.
You know, Robert, retail is such a huge property category in the United States, and we are constantly told that the country is over-retailed. That aside, though, what are some of the retail trends that you're seeing in the United States right now?
Well, Mike, we have kind of a unique focus to retail today. We have really decided that the best opportunity for us investing in retail is to find urban retail opportunities that are in iconic, very high traffic corridors in center cities, very dense areas, of which there are really only a few across the country. So it's a very focused business, and we love it because, frankly, the key, you asked about trends, the key trend is that in urban retail, particularly the sort of high-end urban retail where we're focused, we're seeing better rent growth in this sector than, first of all, any other sector in retail, but maybe even more important, better than any other sector in commercial real estate, period. With most of the markets where we invest over the past couple of years have seen 10% or higher annual rent growth. So certainly the big trend is rent growth, and the rent growth is being driven by a combination of strong tenant demand from tenants who frankly can afford to pay a lot in rent, but also by scarcity of supply, which continues to be impacted by really very strong barriers to entry for new supply. And I think the most important trend that underlies the demand story is really the urbanization of America. And you might say, okay, so what's so new about that? That started probably 200 years ago in the United States.
Right.
But the urbanization of America really stopped after World War II. You had a continuing move to MSAs. But really, the baby boomers abandoned city living for the affordability and convenience and perceived, you know, security of the suburbs. And when people left the cities, frankly, the retailers soon followed, and you saw not just the big guys like Macy's and Bloomingdale's, Sears leaving the cities, but all the other retailers as well. And a retail development boom ensued that today most all institutional owners of retail are invested in really four groups, retail groups that are all in the suburbs. It's enclosed malls, grocery-anchored shopping centers, power centers, and discount centers. There's no urban retail category that people speak about, yet that's where we're invested. We have over $1 billion invested in this sector with probably about 35 investments spread across the country in 10 different markets. And just to give you an example of what I'm talking about, in 1950 in Washington, D.C., population peaked in the city of D.C., now not including the MSA, in the city limits, 802,000 people was the peak population that occurred back in 1950. For the next 50 years, the population in the city of D.C. dropped every year, and it bottomed out in 2000 at about 570,000 people. And then something amazing happened. I mean, really spectacular. A 50-year trend completely turned around. And the population started growing. People started moving back into the city. And it recently in 2012, D.C. had 632,000 residents, which was up 10% from its low about 10 years earlier. That's a significant trend that we're seeing in almost every major urban market where we invest, and there are 10 of those across the country. In every one of those markets, we're seeing a resurgence of folks moving into the city, whether it's young adults graduating from college, millennials in their 20s and 30s, or empty nesters looking for a smaller home. All these groups want to move to a dynamic, fun, urban setting with sidewalks and public transportation, amenities, restaurants, entertainment, etc. And that demand is really driving retailers' interest in urban retail, because they will follow, frankly, the money and the people where the buyers are. And also, tenants can afford, frankly, to pay a lot in rent for these locations, because they offer more than your typical mall location in the suburbs.
Right. Well, what I'm curious about, Robert, is which retailers are you seeing that are being especially successful with the urban retail format?
Well, I would say, first of all, retailers with great brands. And I'm going to concentrate my remarks mostly on primary retail corridors that have achieved a real critical mass, a number of retailers that have exceptional traffic, and these would include, obviously, Madison Avenue and Fifth Avenue in New York, the Magnificent Mile in Chicago, Michigan Avenue, Oak Street, Union Square in San Francisco, etc. So there are 10 of these across the country where we focus, and in these locations where people will pay between $100 a foot net, and in New York, over $2,000 a foot net, the retailers generally have great brands. Usually they're global brands. And also, interestingly, they are driving significant sales at their internet sites. And what these tenants are able to do with this urban retail format, they're really attracted to all the people that walk by their store every day, and it starts at 7, 8 o'clock in the morning with people going to work. And it continues through the day. The tourists start coming in. People that live in that market are shopping. People that are coming into the market from outside of the suburbs to work in the city. And in these locations, often there's tremendous tourist traffic as well. And just to give you by way of an example, we have in our portfolio approximately 100 tenants in our urban retail portfolio, and they range from Zara to Oakley, Barney's, Vivian Tam, Fendi, Ted Baker, Ralph Lauren, some trendier folks like Rag & Bone and Joseph and Skechers, Sandro, Vivian Tam. Some of these brands you can only find in a few select locations like New York and Los Angeles and Chicago, Miami, or within actually the stores themselves of Bloomingdale's and Neiman Marcus, etc. But these are global brands that are driving significant sales, not just in their store. And this is, I think, a really important point and why urban retail is attractive to these retailers. They're also driving a lot of sales on the internet, and to do that, they've got to build brand. And having a location that where millions of people go by there, and they're going by from 8 in the morning until 10, 11 o'clock at night, till after the restaurants have closed, that gives incredible exposure, branding opportunity, big sign, you know, windows full of their merchandise.
Mm-hmm.
That helps them to drive sales also on the internet. And so for them, the location has value not just because they can drive sales within their store, which they can, but also because they're driving sales, maybe even more sales, on their internet site. And certainly the internet has been having a dramatic impact on retail, but mostly negative when you think about how it's impacting shopping centers in the suburbs, taking away sales from the suburbs. It's actually helping urban retail because retailers are seeing these stores on Madison Avenue and Michigan Avenue in Chicago, Union Square in San Francisco, and Beverly Hills in Los Angeles as branding opportunities, and they'll pay more in rent because of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's interesting, because the online retailing dynamic is different with urban retailers. But I want to back up a minute, because you started off, Robert, answering the question by saying Madison Avenue and Union Square, Rodeo Drive. These have always been urban retail powerhouses. Isn't the trend developing some new retail, urban retail strips or centers or areas rather than the traditional ones? Because, I mean, Union Square has always been a powerhouse. Madison Avenue has always been a powerhouse. Maybe they're more robust today because of this trend than they have ever been. But what about the development of new Madison Avenues and new Union Squares? Is that happening as well?
Well, first of all, within the markets you've mentioned, there's been dramatic change. So in New York, the emergence of Soho, Meatpacking District, Chelsea, even Williamsburg in Brooklyn, has been dramatic. And, for example, in Soho, we've seen rents go from, and this has taken years to develop as Soho has evolved from, you know, a boutique kind of gallery district to a high fashion district. Rents go from $50 to over $1,000 a foot on Broadway, Prince Street, Green Street. The best streets in Soho are commanding extraordinary rents. Now, then to take it further, you know, the emerging markets, because as you say, look, New York, Boston, Chicago, and San Francisco have always been 24-hour markets that have had strong urban retail, but the retail has gotten dramatically stronger over the past 10 years. Rent growth in these areas has been eye-popping. But what's happened is other markets that have evolved into true 24-hour markets that frankly didn't used to be, like parts of Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, Miami, San Diego, Denver, Seattle would be some of the best that I would identify were all markets where we're investing, except for Philadelphia. You're seeing a real emergence of this urban retail, and it's a big trend. In D.C., it's on the East End. It's mostly around the Verizon Center and the older market of Georgetown that just keeps getting better. In Miami, it's really in, first of all, in South Beach along Lincoln Road, that market has just dramatically transformed. And the Gaslamp District in San Diego, I think, is another great example. Lodo in Denver all now have very dynamic, fun, exciting areas to shop with great retailers. And people love to go there. They love to go not just buy things, but walk down the sidewalks, you know, have a cup of coffee in a cafe. It's entertainment as well as actually, you know, I want to go buy something. You may go there and not buy anything and then have a great time.
So here you mentioned eye-popping increases in rental or lease fees in areas like Union Square, Madison Avenue, and whatnot. What kind of percentage are we talking about, Robert? Percentage increase.
So percentage increase. So, well, in New York, Boston, I'm going to go with some of the best markets in terms of rent growth. Certainly San Francisco, the strong areas in L.A., which I would define as not just Rodeo Drive, but the promenade, 3rd Street Promenade in Santa Monica, fantastic. We built and opened the new Apple store on the promenade in Santa Monica. It's an extraordinary store. It's got unbelievable traffic. Robertson Boulevard corridor on the edge of Beverly Hills and Hollywood, all great markets, and where rent growth has been growing at 10% plus per year over the last 2-3 years. Mm. And in some cases, even stronger rent growth.
Okay, now here's the scary part, though, about retailing, Robert. I think you would agree that demographics, psychographics, lifestyles, they change quickly. Consumers are fickle, as on top of all of that. So how sustainable do you think this urban retail trend is? Because when people started moving to the suburbs, I think people thought that was a an arrangement, a living arrangement that was going to last forever, but people tired of that after a while. So how sustainable do you think this is? What kind of lifespan might this urban retailing trend have?
I think that I would agree with, I think, half of what you said. I think that shoppers are fickle. What they're fickle about is whether they're going to buy a bag at Coach, right, or at Louis Vuitton, or at Gucci, or go to a discounter and get something a lot cheaper. What they're less fickle about is the geographic location where they shop, where they like to go to shop, the experience they're looking for shopping, which is often largely driven by where they live. So it starts with, a lot of it starts with where people want to live, and I think they're much less fickle about that. For example, the trend that drove the retail boom in the suburbs was a 50-plus year trend. That was a sustainable, long-term, very powerful trend. And I think we're seeing a similar move now back into urban markets that will last decades. I don't think it's fickle at all, and it's being driven by a massive movement in demand that look, fundamentally, people are going to live and work where they want to be. And today, people want to be in a more urban setting. Doesn't mean they're going to go live downtown, but they might live in an urban node that's right close to downtown that has great mass transportation and density, like a Bethesda or a Ballston in the D.C. area. And similar, nodes around Bellevue outside of Seattle, et cetera, around the country.
So if I'm an institutional investor and I'm buying into this trend, I see this happening and I see that rent growth going on and an improving economy, an awful lot of confluence of factors really coming together that would say go retail, go urban retail. Are you seeing pension funds and other institutional investors starting to commit more dollars to the retail property type right now? And I hate to ask a compound question, but the second part of that question is, how does an institutional investor, if they are heading in that direction, deciding we're going to commit more to retail or we're going to change the nature of the retail investments we're making, how do they really capitalize on the whole urban retailing trend?
Well, I think you asked several questions there. I'd start with, look, I've been talking about things that we find compelling and interesting about urban retail. There's no sure thing in life. We all know that, right? So there are risks. You ask good questions that, could go very differently from the way we think they'll go. And so certainly there's plenty of uncertainty in urban retail. I think that most institutional investors are very concerned about retail in general. Okay, they're concerned that nationwide the amount of space that we have per square feet per capita is very high, super high compared to other parts of the world, including the developed world, Europe, etc. And many folks think that we're over-retailed, and there are huge challenges associated with what used to be considered just rock solid, very low risk retail, like owning a grocery anchored shopping center in a good location. A lot of those centers are really struggling today, particularly the grocery store, because they're getting challenged on the high end from Whole Foods and Trader Joe's and specialty grocers, challenged on the value end by Walmart and Target, etc. And many of them are closing down. And when a grocery store closes down in a shopping center, that is an incredibly binary, cataclysmic event. Because who's going to go in that store? And the grocery store, the anchor, is what's driving the traffic for the inline stores. And with the kind of retail that we're pursuing, our retailers are not dependent on some grocery store staying in business or not. Right? I mean, we don't have a single co-tenancy clause in any one of our leases, which is another wonderful thing about the kind of investing that we do. Yet, it is a very challenging, urban retail is a very challenging business because, first of all, it's very hard to buy. most of the deals are small. You'll buy one townhouse, right, that has one tenant in it, a $5 million deal, a $30 million deal, $15 million deal. And many institutional investors don't want to bother with investment sizes that are that small. You have to have the patience and the organization to be able to accumulate these over time in a market, build a critical mass, and own 15 different buildings that accumulate to a $200-300 million portfolio. So they're small and inefficient, which isn't great for investors who are trying to put out billions of dollars. We love small deals, so we're kind of unique in that way. But also, most of the assets that sell off market. And they sell off market because they're owned by non-institutional owners. They're owned by families, individuals, sometimes by retailers, sometimes by someone who had their own business there and they're retiring and passed away and now it's being sold. And often these folks, they don't do things the institutional way. They don't hire a broker. They don't hire Eastdil. They don't expose it to the market. They'd rather be quiet about it. They obviously still want to get a good price. And I'm not saying that you can go in and necessarily buy it cheaply. It's competitive. A lot of folks are out there trying to, I think, to buy these find these opportunities. But they're off market, so you need the network locally to access the deal flow, which is not easy.
So what about markets, retail markets, that are overlooked right now, where there's opportunities? I think you may have mentioned them earlier. You mentioned the Gas Lamp District in San Diego, which a lot of people don't even know exists because San Diego is just not that well known as a retail center. You mentioned Denver and a certain district there. What would you say to people in terms of opportunities that are not so obvious, like the Union Squares and the Madison Avenues?
I think generally urban retail is overlooked, frankly. And even in the prime areas like New York and San Francisco, the owners of this retail tend not to be the big institutional retail owners that we know and read about in the paper. That said, outside of those sort of, I would say, four really major gateway city urban retail markets, secondary markets that for this kind of retail, although there's still primary markets like Washington, D.C. and Miami and Seattle and Denver, are, I think, going to keep getting better and I think probably are overlooked for urban retail. Also, the rents are lower in these markets, so a 10,000 square foot building will trade for 20% of what it might in a major market, and so the smallest, we bought a $3 million deal in Washington, D.C. last year, and institutional investors for the most part would never do that. So the deal size is a limiting factor. I think that any market that's developing a dynamic urban core where people are moving in droves, there's been a lot of apartment construction over the last 10 years, people want to live there, they want to work there, they want to have fun there. These, in some cases, they're emerging. For example, although we're not investing there today, Buckhead and Midtown in Atlanta,
mm-hmm.
will get there. It's just very early stage, I think. Dallas is getting there in certain parts of the downtown area. So I think that these markets are evolving. I think for retail, some of them, it'll take a while to get there. But others, it's happening right now, like Washington, D.C., and Miami for sure, San Diego. A lot of really interesting things going on and great retailers coming in.
Okay, Robert, I want to conclude this interview then with this question about over-retailing. Is the United States over-retailed? And I want to lead the witness a little bit here because, yes, we're seeing this agglomeration of people in urban areas and the retailers are following the consumers. But as you mentioned, we've got a lot of suburban malls and power centers and whatnot that are losing their anchor retailers, and that's damaging the center as a whole. So Are we over-retailed? Is it just a question of, look, we have some very strong retail centers, and we always got a lot of areas in the United States that are kind of hobbling along? I mean, what's the bottom line here? Over-retailed or not over-retailed?
Oh, I think if you measure up all the retail space in the country, we're significantly over-retailed. And it's in the suburbs. It's most markets that have more than two enclosed malls, right? The fourth or fifth or sixth enclosed mall that's got a Sears in it and a JCPenney's and a vacant anchor, and Penny's might be leaving tomorrow. I don't think those malls survive. If they do, it'll be in something completely repurposed and very different. And I think power retail has challenges. We talked about grocery anchored retail. And so, yes, I think that a lot of these retail formats that are not working are going to become something else. But that doesn't mean that there aren't opportunities for growth in other places. And those opportunities for growth exist where people are moving, where there's significant population growth, where there's significant income growth and household formation. And we believe that those areas are urban. That's where much of America is moving, and there's no question that most of these urban markets, frankly, are significantly under-retailed. And the barriers to entry are huge. Keep in mind that Louis Vuitton will not go on the fifth floor, okay? They're going to be on the ground floor. And so you can't build up with urban retail, and in these urban formats, there are huge constraints to building out laterally because there's already a building next door, right? I mean, most of these sites are filled up, whereas in the suburbs, you just go out and find a vacant site that's another mile up the street and build another shopping center. You can't do that downtown.